The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture entitled The Talmud, The History and Development of the Talmud, is dedicated to the memory of Le'ilui Nishmas, Reb Psachya Meir, and Reb Avraham Olav HaSholem, Mr. Psachya Hertzberg, of blessed memory.
Besides Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, no work in Jewish literature has shaped Jewish thought, practice, and history more than the Talmud. Its legal decisions are the principal source of the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, the legal foundation of Jewish life. The philosophical and moral sections of the Talmud, the Agadata, form the basis of the various schools of Jewish philosophy, as well as much of the commentary ever written on the Torah. Besides being the major source of Jewish practice and thought, its pages contain a virtual encyclopedia of knowledge covering subjects as diverse as astronomy, medicine, history, and the occult. But more than anything else, the Talmud represents the logical system of analysis the Jews have employed from time immemorial to plummet the depths of the most difficult and awesome of all subjects, the Torah. And like the Talmud itself, a true Talmudic scholar, a devoted student of this awesome work, is a synthesis of a vast reservoir of legal, spiritual, and general knowledge who actively probes, questions, and analyzes. Not merely a brilliant thinker and logician, but he is someone who has integrated the vast knowledge and spirituality of the written and oral tradition of the Torah into his very essence. To understand the Talmud is to understand the very soul of the Jewish people and its leaders. Throughout this year's lecture series, we have attempted to impart a sense of the spirituality, dedication, and wisdom of many of the major masters of the Talmud. We have also traced the personal history of these men, their yeshivas, the environment in which they studied and taught, and the institutions that formed the fabric of their social and religious culture. Tonight's lecture is devoted to tracing the history of the text of the Talmud. How was Talmud studied in biblical times? How was it standardized? Who finally wrote it down? It goes without saying that to really and truly appreciate the Talmud, one must be a dedicated and devoted student. Although not a substitute to serious study, this lecture, along with the other lectures in this series, will hopefully give you a greater appreciation of the Talmud's history and structure, and create a logical and coherent framework from which hopefully form a solid base for further studies. In your handouts, on the first page, we quote in paragraph A, quote from a Gemara in Brachos and Hayomet Aleph in 5a. Here the Talmud states quite clearly that when Moses received the Torah and Moshe Rabbeinu received on Mount Sinai the Word of God, it consisted of many different parts. And here we have it. There's the tablets of stone, there's the Ten Commandments, Torah, the law, which refers to the Pentateuch, the commandment, this is the Mishnah. This was really last year's subject. That when the written law was given, there was a vast oral law. The relationship between the oral law and the written law would be something akin, this is Shamsher Fol Hirsch makes the analogy, to lecture notes and the actual lecture. That which is written in the Sefer Torah is the lecture notes. The actual lecture is the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, the oral law. This was given to Moses. So he received the shortened version, the abbreviated version, which was going to be set to text, and as the Torah itself said, that actually was written down prior to Moses' death. The copies were made, there were copies were given, Moses gave to all of the tribes, and from there it became available to the whole people. The Mishnah, though, remained in an oral form, and was handed down from generation to generation in that form. Continues on, says Asher Kosafti, this is an allusion again, what was given to Moshe when he was in the Mount Sinai, first to the prophets and the holy writings, the ideas that were contained in the prophecy of the prophets were all given to Moses. There's nothing was given new. No prophet is allowed to create, to say that, God, I have a new revelation that wasn't given originally to Moses. Everything that was given subsequently was part of the Mosaic revelation. And finally, it concludes, and this is the subject of tonight, Lehoroson. The purpose of all of this was to guide them. And inherent in this is the Gemara, this is the Talmud. That the Talmud was given as well to Moses. What the Talmud exactly is, we're going to go into the further detail. But Moses got the Ten Commandments. He got the Sefer Torah. The Mishnah. The ideas are contained in the prophets and the holy writings. And he received what is the Talmud, which we're going to discuss very soon. So the Talmud, at least in some form, is as old as the Torah itself. And they all, the Sefer Torah, the Mishnah, and the Talmud, at least in some form, all date back to Har Sinai, to Mount Sinai. And we have in paragraph B, the next citation. There is a mitzvah of the Torah, from the Torah, to study Torah. Yishinantum levanecha. This is, one studies, one teaches to one's children, one's students. What does that study consist of? And here the Gemara finds an allusion, and the Rambam rules that this is part of Torah law. That it really consists of three parts. And one should divide one's day into three parts. Part of the day to study Mikra, scripture. Part of the day to study Mishnah. This is the oral law. And a third of the day to Talmud. So the study of Talmud, again, is as old as the mitzvah of studying Torah. The original mitzvah of the study of Torah included the study of Talmud. What is Talmud? We're quoting now two definitions. One is the definition of Rashi. And the Talmud is the analysis of Mishnah. In a lecture we gave last year, just to put this in its proper context, we quoted from a source from the time of the Gaonim that the original Mishnah that was taught by Moses, by Moshe, and was given from generation to generation consisted of 600 sudorim, 600 orders. It was an enormous body of knowledge. Our Mishnah, there are only Shisha Sedarim, there are only six. The original had 600. And according to this work, the Seder Tanoim Vamaroyim, this work which dates from the time of the Gaonim, like circa around the year 9 or 900, 1000, that it was studied in that form. And really people had to dedicate their lives to memorize. You have to realize this was all studied by memory. Until the time of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, says we're dealing with approximately the year 1 of the Common Era. Till the beginning of the Common Era, this is the way it was studied. Until there was a more abbreviated form that was created, which contained only 6. According to the historian Rav Isaac Halevi, basing himself on what seemed from Rav Shmuel Gaon, from a reading of the Yerushalmi Shkolim, that this abbreviated form already was created in the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, circa the year 350 before the Common Era. So it was a question of when this abbreviated form came into being. But the much larger form was the original form. And on this original form, which was the Mishnah, which was put to memory, there was this analysis. And the analysis of this Mishnah is the Talmud. Now let's see how Rashi defines this. This is in the last paragraph on page 1. The logic behind the reasoning of the Mishnah, the understanding as to why various Mishnahs do not contradict one another, and the reasoning behind the rulings of that which is forbidden or permitted, or that which incurs a penalty and that which is not, is called Gemara or Talmud. As we have today, the analysis of Mishnah is Talmud. The Rambam defines it slightly differently. It's basically the same, but slightly differently. Here the Rambam, again, who quotes this ruling, that the study of the oral of Torah has to divide into 3 parts of the day. One should study part of the day, at least until one masters the whole written Torah. Part of the day should be devoted to written Torah, part of the day to the oral Torah, which is the Mishnah, and part of the day, the third, to Talmud, and let's see how he defines it. He should devote, as an attempt to understand and discern, or trace the logical conclusion of a legal matter from its beginning. In other words, he should find is where we have a Mishnah, what is its source? How does the logic, what is the underlying principle, and how does that underlying principle lead to the final ruling? Understand, says, derive rules or principles from other rules or principles. In other words, just like the theorems of geometry are created by the axioms or postulates or theorems, so it's really to create more, so to speak. Compare things to others. Understand the rules by which the Torah is elucidated. Now here he adds, until he knows the essence of the rules. These are the rules, which Rashi does not allude to. But these are, part of those rules are, this is printed in the Siddur in the beginning of Davening, the 13 rules of Rabbi Yishmael, the Klal Uprat, is Kal Vachomer. How does one derive from the written law, the oral law? How do you see it? And derivation of those things which are forbidden or permitted, which are all part of the oral tradition. This is what is called Gemara, a Talmud. So here he adds an added piece here. Not only what he calls Talmud, not only the understanding of the Mishnah as an independent work, but actually how do you put the two works together? How do you put the Mishnah and the Gemara side by side and find, says, well, this law is derived from this verse and these are the rules of derivation. Even though that when Moshe taught the Mishnah, he taught it without the rules, so to speak. He just taught the law. This is the law. You build a sukkah like this and like this or like that. Right? These are laws governing kashrus, or this is the law governing this subject or that subject. The Talmud, though, consists of the understanding of how these two works are bound together. This, besides understanding the work itself, this, where is it derived? What verse do I find that it's hinted at? And that also is included in Talmud. To appreciate the difficulty of what's involved in what we call Talmud, the analysis, or the difficulty of reaching new legal decisions based on old decisions. So as we have here in paragraph E on page 2, this is a medrash, which is called the Yalkut Shimoni on Tehillim. In a similar form, this is also Masechta Sofrim. You find in the tractate Sofrim in the 16th chapter, Halacha Vov. Rabbi Yonai said, everything that the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moshe was said with 49 reasons in support of its being ritually pure and 49 reasons in support of its being impure. Notice he would say a halacha, and he'd say, you know, it's not so clear. One could argue, you know, this law, 49 ways this way. We could argue it 49 ways the other way. And Moshe says, Moshe said to him, so what's, you know, he says, you know, when will we know it clearly? He says, it's really up to the majority to decide. We will never get that clarity. We are human. And part of the process of Torah is the struggle for truth. So we are given, or at least we're assuming that if something is forgotten or we don't know clearly, you know, from the original Mishnah, the original tradition, what to do. Being human means that we tend to analyze things differently than our fellow person. Certain things that we weigh, well, this makes more sense than the other thing, to me seems logical, to the other person doesn't seem logical at all. And the attempt to achieve truth is deemed meritorious by itself, even though we may never achieve the absolute truth. And this is in essence, is part of the idea of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. There's a Gemara in Erevin, in Yud Gimel Amud Beis, that brings the quotes as the arguments of the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. And many years after the schools, it seems, had really ceased to be, or just the original schools, there was now a central Sanhedrin again. And there was a question, who should we rule like? The school of Beis Shammai and the school of Beis Hillel. And they argued this point for some 3 years. Until a voice from heaven came, this is in the Yeshiva of Yavna, a voice from heaven came and said, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, the words of the school of Shammai, Beis Shammai, the words of the school of Hillel, they're all God's words. However, in practical speaking, I'm telling you, rule like the school of Hillel. I'm not saying who's right and who's wrong. I'm not telling you, like, who had it right. But in practical purposes, I want Beis Hillel should be the one that you should follow. And it goes on because, as we discussed in the lecture regarding Hillel, because of the humility that was shown, that they were people that were worthy to be granted this gift, that they should be the teachers of the Jewish people. But in truth, we don't know who was right and who was wrong. The Bas Kol, the voice came out and says, these and those are the words of the living God. The Ritva, the great Spanish commentator, quotes this Medrash in saying, there are 49 ways this way, there are 49 ways that way. Whatever the generation decides, in the sense Hashem is happy with that decision. Because we are human, we are limited. There's part of the notion of this limitation and the skills to transcend our limitations, at least to hone our skills to try to arrive at the truth. The Gemara in Nedarim, and this is on the beginning of page 3, attributes that Moses himself coached the Jewish people, in other words, of how to think, besides giving him the information that was given as part of the Torah given, the written law given, the oral law, gave them the basic rules, you know, of derivation. But to the pilpul, the dialectics, the way of argumentation, how to break something apart, is something that Moshe really didn't spend time on his own trying to coach the Jewish people, that they would have those skills. There'll be a generation left that Moshe himself would no longer be making these legal decisions. He gave them the tools to make those decisions. Not just did he give them the basic rules. Not did he just give them the basic outline of the way of deriving from the Torah of Klal of Prat. Not just the mere rules, not just mere examples, but he really taught them how to think. And this was a gift. This is something that Moshe himself was not required to do. It was something that he gave them. This gift came in very handy soon after Moshe died. And here is a Gemara in Temura, to Zion Amud Aleph in 16a, that when Moshe died in the interim of the days of mourning, it says 1,700 laws of the Oral Torah, which could be reconstructed, means of a Kal Vachomer, Gzeres Shova, the system of reconstruction, they were forgotten. There was a large, maybe it's small compared to the entirety of the Torah, but it was a large section of the Torah that was forgotten. And there were questions asked, and they didn't remember. They went to Yeshua, went to Joshua, and they asked him, what's the law? He says, I don't remember. Like I said, there was a curse of forgetting that was placed on the Jewish people. This is after Moshe died. Asniel ben Knaz, who was the first of the Shoftim, of the judges, after the death of Yeshua and his generation, his colleagues, the Zakenim, the elders, Asniel ben Knaz was able to restore them as a result of those mitoich pilpul, same Lashon pilpul, because of the dialectics. Because of he had been trained, basically, by Moshe, how to think. And even though he no longer had the Mishnah, he no longer had the actual tradition, but he was able to reconstruct it by means of this pilpul. Today we tend to use the word in modern parlance as the word pilpul, very often in the pejorative. You know, it's twisted logic. As the Talmud uses, pilpul really means very accurate, definitive, rigorous logic. And it was by this means, through the general rules and through the guidance of Moshe, that the next generation was able to restore that which was forgotten. All of this, of course, goes into Talmud. So again, we have the Torah Shebiktav, the written law, five books of Moses. We have the Mishnah, which again, according to what seems from, there's a passage in the Talmud and in Chagig and Yadalot Amud Aleph from 14a, but this Gaonic work that attributes that there's 600 orders of Mishnah that date from the time of Moshe. The Talmud is the means of derivation and understanding the Mishnah itself. We're all as old as the Torah. And the means of derivation are A, to understand the Torah that we have, what does this all mean, and B, a means of reconstructing that which is forgotten, or that which is a new question comes up that really has not been discussed before. So it is really, the Talmud is really a way, in a sense, it's very creative. Not only is it's analytical to understand what you have, but you're able really to create that which you don't have, because it's just like the theorems in geometry, you're able to expand. The Talmud here in Sanhedrin in 88b in Peches Amud Beis gives us a like a historical view of what actually did happen through all the generations. We discussed what happened immediately after the death of Moshe. And the Gemara and Temura actually says, for all practical reasons, purposes, really such a massive forgetting never occurred again. The Torah, until the time of Hanukkah, the time of Yossi ben Yoezer, the Torah was preserved in its entirety. There's all those Mishnahs, the Talmud that was taught, I guess, from the time of Moshe, that which was forgotten and reconstructed, all this information was preserved in toto. It was only after the time of Yossi ben Yoezer that the forgetting began. But let's say there is a question that was not resolved. There was a question in a local city, and they didn't know what to do. So here the Gemara says originally there were no disputes. Really, everything came, there was no unanswered. There was no question that remained unanswered. If the local court didn't have a tradition, they didn't decide it on the basis of their own Talmud, their own means of reconstruction. If they didn't have the tradition, they wanted to go to basically a higher authority. And if they didn't, if the local Bezdin didn't go, there were three, there was a system of courts on the Temple Mount. There was one next to the temple itself, the Lishkos HaGozes, in the room of hewn stone, and there were two on the Temple Mount. And each one represented a higher authority. If the local court didn't know, didn't remember, it's a new case, or didn't recall if it's part of the Mishnah, they went to the smallest of the three courts. That was on the beginning of the Temple Mount. If that court had a tradition, they tell them the tradition, everything was fine, they went back home. If the one on the Temple Mount also did not have the tradition, they weren't aware of a tradition regarding this, they went to the next one, which was in the beginning, that was situated at the entrance of the it seems Pesach Azorah, which is probably the Ezra Snoshim, so in the beginning of the courtyard. And if that court hadn't had a tradition, then they went to the highest court. Now again, if that court had a tradition, it was fine. But there's the idea of the buck stops here. Once they got to the highest court and they didn't have a tradition, they didn't leave it unresolved. And it was that court that used these tools to try to reconstruct what must the correct halacha be. All of the minor courts preserve the ancient traditions of the Talmud, but were not involved in the creative process, as they wouldn't rely on themselves to create that which was missing, or to reconstruct, or of a new case that was not covered at all. They left that to the highest court. And then they struggled with this. And it went with the majority view. And how the majority viewed this became the law. The Rambam maintains is, of course, if another generation would come, again the highest court, would review the psak, the ruling of the previous court, and would think it over totally different. So we would follow the last ruling. But it would have to be from the Sanhedrin HaGadol, from the great court on the Temple Mount. As it continues on, though, the idea of a united Sanhedrin really existed till the time of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. According to the historian of Isaac HaLevi, basing himself on a source from Josephus, at the time of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the Romans did not let the Jews have a central court. And as a result, you had schools. You didn't have a central court. You had the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel. And as a result, you had different divergence of opinion without the vote process. A major problem, which the Talmud itself states, is that that had the students of Hillel and the students of Shammai been more dedicated students, they would have thought alike, would have maintained, preserved the ancient traditions better, and there would be less argumentation. The fact is that they thought so much differently, and the original traditions somehow were not preserved in its entirety, they point their finger to some sort of lack in them. But added to this, we have to say historically, they were not allowed to sit together and to hash these things out. So you in the time of Beisham and Beis Hillel, you did not have a central body to deal with these problems. We brought ourselves from the time of Moses to the time afterwards, right after his death, the time of Asniel ben Knaz, all the way during the time when the Sanhedrin was operating to the time of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Yochanan ben Zakkai was of he is called the smallest of the students of Hillel. And yet, the Gemara describes in great detail the grasp of knowledge that he had on top of page 4. And he did not leave unstudied Scripture, Mishnah, Gemara, which is Talmud. It was all of this, the details of the Torah, details of the scribes, the small matters, the discussions of Abaya and Rava. Rashi explains. Again, Scripture and Mishnah as we understood it. Gemara is the analysis of the Mishnah. Details of the Torah is when one reads the Torah, because there's an extra letter here, an extra word here, to its implied meaning. This is really analysis of the Torah itself, rather than trying to link, you know, the Mishnah to the Torah. The discussions of Abaya and Rava, according to Rashi, are new questions were brought up, which we're going to discuss, which were not covered in the body of the Mishnah. Like we have questions today, the new problems that come up. That's the discussions of Abaya and Rava. Yochanan ben Zakkai was lived to be 120. He died approximately in the year 75 of the Common Era. He lived to be 120 years old. Hillel died in the year 10 of the Common Era. He studied all of this from Hillel. So all of this, this is much before the Mishnah itself was codified, right? In approximately the year 190, 180, says Yochanan ben Zakkai had this expertise. The Talmud existed, as well as the Mishnah, much before it came to the form that we have it today. You can just look yourself on the end of page 4, and again, this comes from the time of the Mishnah itself. There was a prohibition that was it was extant during that time, that wanted to discourage the contact with people who compromised their level of observance and their level of scholarship, and did not want, when three people come together and make Birchas Hamazon, have Zimun, you know, the bench together, that they should not include the unlearned together with the learned. They wanted to create a barrier between them. So the unlearned should not have an influence on the learned. What is defined as someone who is unlearned? There's a whole discussion we bring here on page 4 in paragraphs K and L. The halacha, though, is someone is unlearned is someone who is not a master of the Talmud. This is explained as someone who is not mishamish talmidei chachamim, who is not minister to the disciples of the wise. In other words, does not know how to think. One may be an expert in scripture, an expert in Mishnah, but if one is not an expert in analysis, he is considered an am oretz, someone who is unlearned. Again, this again comes from the time before we have the Talmud itself. All of this I wanted just to point out is that we shouldn't come think that Talmud is something that was created during Babylon, as in the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries. The Talmud is as old as the Torah itself. The form that we have is the Talmud, the analysis and discussion of the yeshivas that existed then. Had we gone through a time machine and come through the year 200 before the Common Era and walked into one of their yeshivas, we would have had a different Talmud, as we wanted to preserve the goings on. The Talmud that we have is preserving the discussions and analysis of the Mishnah during the years of, you know, the year 300, 400, 500 of the Common Era. But Talmud itself is really as old as the Torah, and really dates back from the time of Moshe. Now, just as this is a point that I just wanted you to, just because it's really very basic to understanding of the whole oral tradition. The Mishnah originally, as we said, was oral, as well was the Talmud. Here on page 5, you can look yourself, we quote the sources for this. This is taken, this is one of the sources, this is taken from Gemara and Tumura and Yedalo and Beis 14b, that the oral law was to remain oral and the written law to remain written. And in fact, this is the one, it says, he who learns from the writings, this is the time of Rabbi Yochanan, this is already in the time of the Talmud, before the Talmud is written down, that he who learns the oral law says, from a book receives no reward. And that's not the way to learn. You have to learn orally. You have to learn, if you don't know the material, learn from a Rebbe. But everything is oral. At the time of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, the Agadata, there were books of the Agadata, which are the philosophical commentary, the philosophical parts of the Talmud, that which deals with understanding of scripture, not in a legal form, were already written in book form. And they did this because memory started to wane. There were others of his period did not look. There are quotes in Rishuv and Levi, never looked into these books. He felt for himself it was something he didn't need. Rabbi Yochanan felt he allowed himself to read these books. The Talmud, though, was still unwritten. There's a question if the Mishnah was written yet. The Rambam maintains, and there are sources from Gaonic sources that would seem to suggest that the Mishnah was already written after the time of Rabbi Yehuda, at the time of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Mishnah, it was written. But not everyone agrees to that. Rashi is of the school that the Mishnah was not written yet. The Mishnah was written much later. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the editor of an oral tradition, but it was still all memorized. And it was not written. But during the time of the Talmud itself, it certainly was not written. What we do have, though, is, this is in paragraph B on page 5, that people kept their own notes. Notice they didn't really study from them. When they taught orally, but they kept their own private notes, you know, just so they should remember. But it was not made public knowledge, and it was not taught in the written form. It's not clear when the Talmud that we have, was finally written down. Rav Isaac Halevi assumes that it was written down at the end of the period of the Rabbanan Savaroy. This was the last generation. If you have your in the sheets, it is the last and the end, last page. And we're going to go over this in musician. The third generation, if you're the last at the end of the far right-hand column. This is the Rabbanan Savaroy. These were the last of the sages of the Talmud. We find third generation, the bottom of the right-hand column, which is from the year 558 to the year 589. These are dates that I place. These are approximate dates. This is the Ksivus HaTalmud. Is written down. This is only then. This is the far right-hand column. If you see third generation, 558-589 in the Hebrew Ksivas HaTalmud. During this whole period of time, the Talmud was all oral. And if one studies Talmud, it's just an amazing amount of knowledge to memorize. And it was all memorized. So again, it's possible people had their own private notes. But as a work that was studied and taught, it was really studied and taught by rote. I mean, it was all we're dealing with analysis. It's not just mumbling words. But it was all put to memory. It's an amazing feat. I'd like now to go over, now just having that in mind, again, it says the Talmud itself is as old as the Mishnah, which is as old as the Torah itself, the time of Moshe, in some form, was there and handed down from master to disciple. I'd like now, and this is a brief history, of what occurred during these generations. Again, if you look at the last page, where you can flip back and forth here. If you notice the last generation of the Tanoim. And here in the Hebrew, we have Brisas HaMavirim HaMishnah. This is, again, these are approximate dates. The year 192, which marks the death of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, to the year 230, which marks the death of his grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Nasiah. So we have approximately over 40 years. They had a form of Talmud. And we call these are the Brisas HaMavirim HaMishnah. We know of Brisas. These are all, the Mishnah, he says, is an outline of a very large work. And there are Brisas, that which is outside this outline. As we said originally, there were 600 Siddurim, there were 600 orders. It was reduced to 6. Where did all this other knowledge, where was that preserved? It was preserved in the Brisos. That's one kind. Brisa means outside in Aramaic. That's one form of Brisa. The other Brisa form of Brisa is a Brisa which is like the Talmud. It's really a commentary on the Mishnah. And the Brisas that we have that are quoted in the Talmud come from that generation. Rabbi Gamliel III, we'll go through, was the son of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the editor of the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Nasiah was in turn his son. And Rabbi Oisha, who was a contemporary of both of them, was an author of many of these Brisas. But the understanding, where did they get this understanding of the Mishnah? They got it from their Rebbe, ultimately, from Yehuda HaNasi. This is a preservation of the Talmud at the time of the Mishnah. This generation, by the way, was not just involved in teaching, but they were involved in creating legislation as well. And I'll just give you a sense, because this is a We're dwelling upon this because this is, in a sense, a lost generation. There's very little written about this generation, but their contribution was very great. And in here, we'll just briefly just touch upon this. There was a legislation made, is how Rashi understands this, in the time of Rabbi Gamliel III, is the first of those listed here, to disallow ritual slaughter by a Samaritan or Kuthian or Kusi. His shechita was not considered valid because they were afraid there was a number of them that were idolaters. This was done in that generation. As we just peruse through these things, on page 6, there's a question of how to understand the Mishnah. There was one explanation which Rav quoted, the famous Rav, which really the Talmud says reflected the opinion of Rabbi Gamliel III, Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Rebbe. But his contemporaries, the sages who were contemporaries of it, had a different view. Again, they were explaining the Mishnah, and they taught what their teachings went to the generation of the Amoraim. Rav, when we have the teachings of Rav, his teachings really reflect not only Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, but the generation that followed him. So when we hear something from Rav, this passage happened to tell us what the source is, but where did he get it from? It's quite likely he got it from this last generation of Tanoim. There's a term which is called Rabbi Senu, our masters, which is brought very often in the Talmud. Our masters refers to the Sanhedrin that existed in this interim period between the end of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the end of the Mishnah, and the beginning of what we call the Talmudic period. These our masters were this last generation, were like Tanoim. We deal with them, we quote them. They said this and they said that, and they're often brought. One interesting legacy we have from them, which is on page 7, which is, again, it seems to have been post-Talmudic legislation. They were not only interpreters of law, they were legislators of law as well. Really did not come to a close as a unified body until after the death of Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, and this is his last generation of Tanoim. Up until that time, there was one unified Sanhedrin, as we call this the Masifta. It was this last one, and it had the power of instituting laws that would be binding for all of Jewry, because you need a central body to do that for all of Jewry. After the death of Yehuda Nasiya, there developed three distinctive Masiftas. It really was divided to three. One under the leadership of Rabbi Yochanan in Tveria, one under the leadership of Rav in Sura, and one under the leadership of Shmuel in the Hardah. Once there was no longer a unified Sanhedrin, there could be no unified legislation. So this group, this last generation of Tanoim, has significance beyond the power of their interpretive power, because they actually carried with them the traditions of the last generation, but they uniquely could institute legislation. One is that we know, this is based on Torah law, that menstrual blood creates, after a woman has menstrual blood, there's a period of separation. However, between the blood of which is Dam Basulim, the blood which is not menstrual blood, it comes from the same general area, but it's the breaking of the hymen, which is a different form of a blood source. From Torah law, and even early rabbinic law, that blood is like a wound. It does not affect the relationship between a husband and a wife. That Sanhedrin, this Sanhedrin, which was the last of the Sanhedrin, of our masters, instituted the Dam Basulim, the blood from the breaking of the hymen, is rabbinically has the same status of menstrual blood, and therefore there has to be a certain time of separation. This is all from that. This is one of the legacies of that Sanhedrin. Is it really? It's the last, you know, last central Sanhedrin in Eretz Yisrael. This is Rabbi Seinu. And he says, and they did not all, they did it through votes, you know, they discussed it like any Sanhedrin as we went through before. And, again, you could look through the various quotes. Reb Oishe, it seems, on paragraph I, was a member of that group. We have Reb Yanai in paragraph H, was a member of that group. These were the teachers of Reb Yochanan. These were students of, this is Reb Yehuda Hanasi, Reb Chia. This was the last generation of Tanoim. They made up this last Sanhedrin. They left us a legacy of legislation, but they left us a legacy of Talmud, the interpretation of the Mishnah. How did the yeshivas look? How did a yeshiva, a normal yeshiva, the Sanhedrin, the Masifta, how did it look? So first of all, we have a sense that it was big. Here on page 8 in paragraph A, when the main body of rabbis departed from the school of Rav, there remained behind 1,200 rabbis. As we stated before, we've gone through this before, the semester, there were actually two semesters of the yeshivas, the sifta. 2 5-month periods. The intercession was in the month of Nisan and the month of Tishrei, the time of the holidays. It was also time of agricultural work. The other months were months of study, and each semester culminated in 1 month where the whole tractate of the semester was studied. And in the Masiftas, all the yeshivas came together under the leadership of the Rosh Masifta, the head of the Masifta, be it Rav or Shmuel and his generation and other generations was others. And they went through the whole tractate. When the semester finished, this refers to then those who came, you know, to the Masifta from other places left. But you still had a group that stayed all year round. So there was 1,200 in the time of Rav. In the time of Huna, there was 800. And he says, when they stood up after Rav Huna's discourses and shook out their garments, it says, the dust rose so high, this is quoting on page 8, that it obscured the light of day. It was big. So the first thing is, you want to get what the Masifta, again, we're referring to Masifta, different than yeshiva, and this is a term we've used before. The Masifta was the mini Sanhedrin. In other words, you had not only students, but yet all the scholars were there. In a session, here we have paragraph B, in a session, when it was taught, there was information, when they said they were experts, not necessarily of analysis, but experts of information. As we said before, their brises, there were originally 600 orders of Mishnahs. They were all reduced to just to 6. So it was an enormous amount of information that was preserved by people dedicated their lives to be walking encyclopedias. They weren't necessarily experts of analysis, but they were able to preserve the traditions. So these people, these were called Tanoim, the experts of the brises. And the great Rashi Masiftas, the heads of the Masiftas, the Talmudic scholars, they all knew the Mishnah by heart. But they necessarily didn't know every single brisa. I mean there's only, in the previous generations, it seems that it was possible for a person to be the expert in everything. But as the generations kept on going and receding, you had specialists. And these Tanoim, there were specialists, used to teach, before the Shir at least, used to tell the Rosh Hashiva, says, share their knowledge from their brises. But it was not done in public. After the Rosh Hashiva heard all of this, and analyzed this, then he would give his shir, probably using that information or what he felt that was applicable or not. When he would speak, though, he would have to address an enormous amount of people. We're speaking of specialists, those who were gifted with a sound mind, tremendous memory, great analytic skill, are not necessarily have loud voices. And they were Amaroyim. They were people, scholars, not the highest level scholar necessarily, but scholars who were gifted with loud voices, who used to shout, the sound systems that we have today, used to various groups, and the Rosh Hashiva would tell them over what he wanted them to say, and they with booming voices would go and tell the assembled. Rav Huna had 13 of them. This was in paragraph A, 13 interpreters, Amaroyim. This is the public session. And here we have, in the bottom of page 8, in the bold print, you say that this Tana was reciting the teaching, the presence of Rav. This is what he says. It wasn't at the public session. So this was done privately. What did the public heard? The public heard the Amora. This is the one with the loud voice. So we know about Tanoim and Amaroyim, and we generally think about Tanoim as the authors of the Mishnah, Amaroyim as authors of the Talmud, but it's also used as experts of the Mishnah or Brises, and Amaroyim as the interpreters, the living loudspeakers at the time of the lecture. So we have each word, the word Tana has two words, one is the author, and one is just the expert, not necessarily with any understanding. And the word Amora has the author, those who analyze, but also says the loudspeakers. And that's how it's used. So you get a sense of what it was to be at the lecture. Also, then when they had the lecture, there was a review of the lecture. And here we have on the top of page 9. On an evening was referring to a specific thing that Rav, when he studied in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi delivered the lecture at night, and he thought it over, and then the next morning he went and he decided otherwise, and he retracted. So it wasn't necessarily that it was just once, and they were in the thing. He gave a lecture, and in the morning he thought of it, and he gave another lecture. It was a retraction. And the Gemara points out the importance of being at all lectures. In other words, you shouldn't just leave it and you feel you know it. It says, if you come back again, maybe he's retracted. We've discussed about the brises, which were the brises. We have two types, as we said, with two types Tanoim, two types Amaroyim, two types of brises. One is the general information that was not included in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is just really shorthand, it's an outline. The others are the brises, which are really a running comment, like a Talmud of the Mishnah. But it was from the generation, of the Tanoim. One of these brises is the brisa of Devei Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael was a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva. He had a yeshiva that lasted for a long time, hundreds of years. And they had that yeshiva had the brises. It was really a Talmud of the Mishnah. And it is often quoted, Tana Devei Rabbi Yishmael. It was really, this is the equivalent of the Talmud in brisa form. And very often it quotes a commentaries of the Mishnah from this, again, from this earliest Talmud. Can we speak about how long old the Talmud is? We do have the Talmud in brisa form. One part of Talmud, we say, of course, is analysis of the Mishnah. Another part, though, is new questions, not covered in the Mishnah. And I'll just give you a few examples here on page 10. Rabbi Yirmiah, the first two is Rabbi Yirmiah was known, even though there were others as well, to have a special talent, to think of new questions which really deal with not only how to deal with new questions, but it really focuses on the basic principles that would go beyond these specific questions. Here says if you find a lost object, we know we have to return it. If the person gave up hope, we assume it's been there a while, the person gave up hope, you're allowed to keep the lost object. But if something was left there on purpose, didn't drop out of a person's hand, was left there on purpose, and it was placed in a certain configuration, we assume that even if it's taken, the owner does not give up hope. Because he knows he made a certain sign, a configuration, or a sign of the object, and he is assuming that the finder, assuming if he's an observant Jew, was going to announce it that there was a lost object, then he would go and track down that person and tell him, I left it in this and this form. The Talmud deals with it lying in a pyramid form, as if I have three coins. Like silver dollar, a silver half dollar, and this is in a quarter. So it's in pyramid form. The nickel, maybe a dime. So I know it didn't fall out of someone's pocket. The person left it there. If I find it, and I'm afraid someone's going to take it, I'm allowed to take it, but then I call out, I found coins. And the person will go and identify it because it's a special identification. I don't assume it just fell off the person's, by accident it formed a pyramid. Rabbi Yirmiah, that's the mission. That's the explanation of the Mishnah. Rabbi Yirmiah said, there are other ways this could be. What happens if they're in a straight row, or they're in a circle, or they're in a triangle, or they're like a ladder? What about this way, that way? That's not discussed in the Mishnah. These are the kinds of questions Rabbi Yirmiah would ask. You could look at the other example here is on paragraph B. Rava as a very which the Tosas some comments are things which could never happen. We know the firstborn of a child, the firstborn of a Jewish child, a Jewish mother, needs to have a pidyon haben, unless it's from a Kohen or a Levi. There's to be redemption of the firstborn. If it's an animal, the firstborn of a kosher animal is brought to the, and if there's no moon, there's no blemish, is brought to the temple. It had all kinds of different thorns, but it has to come out of a normal, basically a normal birth, not a C-section. It's a normal birth. The firstborn coming out normally. The Gemara has all kinds of different situations, but what happens if it comes out like this or like that or the other one? I'll give you one of the last ones. These are all theoretically, as the Tosafot says, they probably never could occur or would occur, but it's to understand really what the basic principles are, which we may even use today. What is the law if one joined two wombs of two animals to each other, and the fetus issued from one womb and entered the other? And so it went out of one, so from the first one it went out for sure, but now it went into the other. Let's say the first mother, this is not the firstborn of the first mother. So it's not a firstborn. But it went into that second mother. Now that second mother, that no longer had a child, or didn't have a child before this, it's a firstborn of that second mother. Would coming out of that second mother give it the status of being a firstborn? These are the kinds of, even though theoretically maybe it could have never occurred that it could go into another womb of an animal, but it's to understand what are the basic principles of what's considered the firstborn. Today, we could have this possible to grow a fetus outside of the womb. We do this with animals today. And it's possible to insert, at least in the earliest stages, a growing fetus from another animal into a cow. is that a firstborn? They didn't have this technology then. But the principles were important, that it is important to know what the guiding rules. Does this animal have to produce this baby, or it just comes out of the baby even though it didn't produce the baby? That would be considered a firstborn. This again, this the Talmud deals with. Because very often it's dealing with not only real legal matters, but theoretical questions which eventually could touch real legal matters. We discuss the analysis, we discuss the brises, which are the earliest form of Talmud. We discuss new questions. I just like to touch upon something we've gone before. The Talmud, this analysis was going on throughout where the Torah was studied. And the basic centers were Israel and Babylon. These were the basic centers. But the Talmud that was studied, this analysis that happened in Israel or Babylon, did not happen in a vacuum. That there was a constant, there was a interspersing of ideas and communiques between the various yeshivas, the Babylonian yeshivas and the Israeli yeshivas, the Palestinian yeshivas, the Israel yeshivas, so that those on one area would know what's happening on the other, take it into account. In the Babylonian Talmud, there's much quotes of the great sages of Israel. In Israel, there are many quotes of the great sages of Babylon. And in a certain sense, that both they were, even though they were hundreds of miles apart, but actually they were doing them together. And here we bring just two examples here on page 11, on paragraph A and B, where questions that were discussed in one yeshiva. In the first example, Rava ruled a ruling. Rabbi Abba in Israel heard about this and told him, again, send him a message that it was an error in his opinion. It didn't happen of that. Even though Rava's in Babel, Babylon, this is Rabbi Abba's in Israel, Rabbi Abba knew what was happening in Babylon. A similar situation, paragraph B. Rav Chisda, who was in Surah in Babylon, made a ruling. This is that ruling came to attention of Rabbi Ami, who was a contemporary of Rav Chisda's. And he commented on this. And again, just to show that it did not happen really in a vacuum. How this occurred, we have in paragraph C, and this is, we're quoting from the letter of Rav Shuragon, there were scholars that were appointed to go back and forth from Babylon to Israel so that the two yeshivas, the yeshivas there, should be linked. There came a time, though, that the Talmud, which was studied, became, in a sense, standardized, as well as we have today. And Rav Shuragon starts about the problems of standardization. In other words, the Talmud, the analysis of one, as it's given over, is not necessarily given over in the exact wording. You know, even though it's preserved, but different people have different versions of this. Talmud said the analysis was not necessarily preserved from one generation to the other. It was felt it was obvious. Another generation felt, well, it's not so obvious anymore. We should include it in the regular course in the what's taught. And this is how Talmud, as Shuragon explains, from one generation to the other, became more detailed. It was because the second generation felt, you know, this has to be preserved. The other generation, when they read this, they understood it. No one had to speak this out. Now we're looking at this, and I see this. My students really don't get this. So it's important. We're going to study the Mishnah. This comment has to be added to the Mishnah. We're going to study, and it's going to be preserved. And the next cycle, when we study this, is going to be included in the general course of study. Just to give you one example, and this Rishur Gaon is on paragraph C, and it's a very important example. This is on page 12, and this is in the bottom page 12 here in paragraph C. Rav Chiya bar Abba, Rav Asi, and Rava bar Nosson were sitting together with Rav Nachman, and they were discussing a certain issue. And they made a comment, and Rav Nachman said, "You know what you said?" He says, "You know, it's correct, because Shmuel, his Rebbe, Shmuel said this as well." And he asked them, says like this, is it part of your Talmud? He says, yes. Because that comment is not only do I know this, but this is all part of the Talmud. And there's this, the text of commentary on the Mishnah. It's part of it already. And Talmud, as we say, was not only, as we say, is ancient in this analysis of the Mishnah, but it was actually, as according to Shmuel Gaon, it was preserved in steps. In other words, an early generation who goes through this Mishnah, the students see this clearly, that's what the Mishnah means. There was no reason for them to add this, you know, to the vast amount of knowledge they have to keep in their mind to this analysis, because it's obvious. Another generation, though, doesn't find it that obvious. It was added. And this little by little, layer by layer, the Talmud came into being. And here we quote on page 13. In this manner, the Talmud was expanded generation after generation. Every single generation would set into the Talmud the matters that were now in doubt. And the instances and problems that they would have, they felt it's noteworthy. We can't expect the students just to, you know, suffice the old information. They need this new extra. They need this new extra bit of commentary. Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchok, which represents another generation, a further generation, commented on this. He looked at himself. I'm a teacher and a systemizer of tradition. He looks as Gemarna v'Sedarna. No, this is a lotion from Gomorrah. He is a preserver of Talmud. And Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchok was, again, of those who was involved in preserving a standardized text of Talmud. Again, Talmud is how they analyze the Mishnah. Some of it was preserved, some of it wasn't preserved. Through different levels of generations, more and more was preserved. Some was preserved in terms of just the names. Omer Rav Yehuda, Omer Rav. They kept what Rav Yehuda Rav said. Sometimes they quoted what Rav Nachman said. Sometimes we have what is known as a Stam Gemara. You read Gemara, there's no title to it. The Gemara makes a comment. Who wrote that? And it seems that the Stam, is without approbation, we don't know who wrote this. Without attributing who was the author of this, it seems, again, this was layer upon layer. One generation felt, well, this should be added to the curriculum. Okay, it was added. That's a Stam Gemara. It was decided, well, this is the interpretation, and that's it. Next time around they studied this, they didn't add a name. Someone said this. The yeshiva said this, and it became part of the curriculum. I just give you some examples here, and if, again, it would just be worthwhile, again, if you look at, from this page 13 to the last page, again, this is page 3, this is paragraph A. Page 13, paragraph A. There is a comment here. There is a Stam Gemara. He says the beginning of the Mishnah is there's no priest. The latter part of there is a priest. But the Talmud says is there's no, it doesn't say who said this. Rav Papa, and if you'll notice, Rav Papa's fifth generation. Because of the authors of the Talmud, he's fifth generation. Rav Papa said, you may infer from this, now he's giving an inference from that Stam Gemara. He says, well, from that statement we can infer, you know, this and this. He is commenting on a Sodom Gomorrah that existed before his time. There's a, on the beginning of page 14, there's a Sodom Gomorrah, and we find Rav Nachman. You know, you said just on the last, as we have learned, which was quoted before, the Sodom Gomorrah. This was if a robber himself caused damage to a field, which we interpreted to refer to a case where he showed the field to bandits. There was one robber showed the field to a gang, and he's responsible for something happened to that field. Rav Nachman is quoting something which is, again, we interpreted. It became standard. Rav Nachman is second generation. Just to show you that there was interpretations that were handed down became standard. There's an on paragraph C again, there's an interpretation again, and there's no name to it, but Rabbi Zera in the Yerushalmi says, quotes this. Rabbi Zera is third generation. Something that's part of the curriculum of the yeshivas, when did it become part of that curriculum? So we had, became in stages. The Talmud came to its final form in the time of Rav Ashi. This is on page 15. Rav Ashi, together with his colleague Ravina, created the final form of the Talmud. And those that follow them added very, very little. And if you see, says Rav Ashi in this on the last page is the sixth generation. Just to give you just two in the last two pages here, and then I'll just to review the generations. Rav Ashi, it seems, sat. This is how Rav Isaac HaLevi understands. Besides being the head of the Misifta of Moshe Machasi of Sura, which he was for some 55 years, and again going through tractate after tractate, year, you know, two tractates a year, he also came with the other sages of that generation and wanted to create a standard text to the Talmud. The reason he did this was twofold. Rav Ashi was the greatest authority in his generation. All the other sages, in a sense, were secondary to him. So he commanded the authority to create a standard text. The situation in Israel was such that the yishuv already, and as the settlement already had come to an end because of the Christian pressure of the persecutions. There was for all practical purposes there was no Talmudic presence in Israel. All the Talmudic sages of Israel had moved to Babylon. So he was able to, what in Babylon, yeah. And Rav Ashi says, was able to bring all these people together under his leadership. The political situation in Persia was such that soon after the death of Rav Ashi, as we're going to discuss in the next lecture, everything unraveled. There was terrible persecutions. Life was almost untenable during that period of time. And he realized, in a sense, it's now or never. He himself, Rav Ashi, as we brought before, was a student of Rava. Ravina was a student of Rava. Rava and Abaye together, in their period of time, seem to have put the Talmud, much of what we have already in its form. They felt now is the time to finally put its final form. So the sages of Sura, which of Moshe Machasi, South Babylon, which was Rav Ashi's area, with the sages of Pumpadisa, came together not at the, you know, at the end of the semesters, This is where all the great gatherings were. But they came together in a special conclave, this is how Rav Isaac Halevi learns, to standardize the Talmud. And what they did was one was they standardized the Talmud, and second of all, says they concentrated, condensed much of the learnings of the other tractates which we don't have Talmud on, which they themselves studied in depth, and put what's from the 60 or 63 tractates into some 33 tractates. So they took the information of Tyrus, of the laws of ritual purity, they took from the laws of Zroyim, of the laws of title, the entitlements and the tithes, of the plantings of Israel, and they took all that information and put it interspersed it into the other tractates. So there would be a much smaller amount that would have to be put to memory if it was all memorized. They felt it would just be too much to memorize everything. So they concentrated the teachings of the Talmud into, instead of what would be 60 tractates of Mishnah, they put it into these 33. So on the Mishnahs of Nezikin, of damages, or the laws of marriage, or the laws pertaining to the holidays, it would be interspersed comments from other Mishnahs of that we don't have Talmud on. So he arranged the Talmud in a way that all this information became now concentrated. And he did this outside of the regular conclave. We said they had a conclave twice a year. This was outside of the conclave, because these conclaves were really held at separate places. In southern Babylon, which was in Mosul Machasia, in northern Babylon, in Pompidisa. So the conclave, in those conclaves, you didn't have all the rabbis together. You had only part of the rabbis. There was a special conclave to create the standardization of the Talmud. And in that, Rav Ashi was really the leader and the teacher, and they went over the standard text of the Talmud. And Rav Ashi is the one who created this final text. You can look on, on the citations here, that there was a questions that were placed to the assembly. It doesn't say who asked the question. And Ravina says to Rav Ashi, he says, I have a comment on this. Rav Ashi doesn't say is the one, this is on page 15 in paragraph B. It doesn't say Rav Ashi is the one who asked this. But it's evident that Rav Ashi was the one who was in charge. And if someone had a comment, you went to Rav Ashi. Here's just another example on paragraph C. This is Gemara taken from Gemara and Ksubas. This was a quote Rav Papa said in the name of Rava. And there was a whole discussion. And up in we have, this is in the bottom of page 15. Rav Acha, the son of Rava, who, by the way, at one time was the head of the Masifta of Pumpadisa, of the north, said to Rav Ashi, wait a minute, I have a problem here. Rav Ashi's name is not mentioned above. It's a quote, Rav Papa said the name of Rava. Rav Ashi's not mentioned. Yet Rav Acha now says to Rav Ashi, I have a problem with this. And here to this, Rav Ashi said he to him is in bold print, I am in effect saying, and then he quotes, Rav Ashi didn't say anything. But it seems clear that Rav Ashi was involved in systemizing the Talmud. He basically said over this, even though his name is not mentioned, because now they're trying to get a standard text. And when he was challenged, he said, well, I meant to say this and this. He was not mentioned. He was just saying over somebody else's. It was important. It was well known. Usually when you have somebody said in the name of somebody else, it means we don't know this unless this rabbi would have told us. That's what he says. So if Rav Ashi would have said, Omer Rav Ashi, Omer Rava, it means the assembled never heard of this before. They don't know from this. Rav Ashi is the one who taught us that Rava told us this. In these cases, we all know this. This is common knowledge. But he's repeating it because he wants to get it right. This is something we all know. And on this, when he's challenged, he says, well, I meant to say this and this. a similar idea we have, and as you can see, so I bring two other the other instances to this. Here again, we have situations. You can look at yourself from Gomorrah Nida, Gomorrah and Chulin. Again, it says that Rav Ashi is what Rav Ashi is really. Rav Ashi is not mentioned before, and yet when there's a challenge to the Gomorrah, Rav Ashi says, "I meant to say this and this." Because Rav Ashi was not saying something new, he was standardizing what really was the text. And in that process, he was challenged. And he says, I meant to say this and this, because I'm really saying over what was really common knowledge. But I want to get it right. So I want to say it over. So he's saying it over the way this is going to be preserved for eternity. That's what Rav Ashi did. So again, the Talmud basically is something which was studied from time immemorial. The Mishnah that we have, the final Mishnah, and the Mishnahs from the time, is it all from the time of Moshe. The final Mishnah, though, that we have is from the time of Yehuda HaNasi. And there's Talmud on that. The original Talmud came from the disciples of Yehuda HaNasi, from the next generation, from all those Brises, and it kept on accruing. This accumulated thing of analysis is what we have as the Talmud. In some times they said names, in others it became, in that period of time, became what was standard curriculum. At the time of Rav Ashi, it was put to the standard text that we have now, and into the form that we have now, that we only have Talmud on some of the tractates, but not all of the tractates. And the Talmud from the other tractates were borrowed, so to speak. If they found a place that would like be able to fit it in, they would fit it in there. So it would be a lot easier to memorize. Because Rav Ashi, the scholars, the sages, the scholars of his time, realized that it would be impossible to put all of this into, you know, to memory, especially now that they realize the persecutions would be coming, dispersions would be coming, so they tried to concentrate it. And even in after Rav Ashi's times, again, it wasn't totally finished, as we bring this last thing from 16, that again, there were questions what Rav Ashi exactly said here. Rav Acha said this, Ravina taught that, of what did Rav Ashi, because after he died, there's students, hey, what did he say exactly? It took a little while, took us 100 years until it came finally to the form that we have today. But 95% of what we have today is from Rav Ashi. I just very briefly, like the last page, just a sense of the flow of what happened here. Yeah. We begin the last generation of Tanoim. This is Ram Gamliel, this is Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rav Oisha. This is the final Sanhedrin. We have much material from them, their teachings in Brisa form, or really the initial form of what we have as Talmud, the explanation of the Mishnah. We have the first generation of Amoraim. This is afterwards. And this is referred now, we no longer have a central Sanhedrin, at least for many of, there appear many of these. This is, we have Rav and Shmuel in Bubble, Rabbi Hanina, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, they're in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Kahana and Rav Asi were contemporaries of Rav. Rabbi Yochanan, which was the Talmud of Rabbi Hanina, was a younger colleague of Rav Shmuel. We have the second generation. This was in the year 253. The second generation from 253 to 300. We have the students of Rav and Shmuel, Rav Yehuda, Rav Huna, Rav Nachman. We have in Eretz Yisrael the students of Rabbi Yochanan, Reish Lakish, Rabbi Elozer, Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi. This is different than the Rav Asi before. Rav Chiya Bar Abba, Rabbi Yosef ben Chanina, Rabbi Yabohu. Many of these we've discussed in detail in previous lectures. The third generation. This is from 300 to 325. These are approximate dates.
There's Rabba, Rabbi Yosef in Bavel, Rabbi Zeru start off in Bavel, move to Israel, Rabbi Abba in Israel, Birmir, Rabbi Yonah, Rabbi Yossi, these are all in Israel, and this last group form many of the prominent sages of the Talmud Yerushalmi in the latter thing. The fourth generation, we have Rabbi Mani, Rabbi Yossi Bar Oven, these are the last of the great sages of the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud, the analysis of the Mishnah in Israel. This is year from 325 to 352 approximately. During that time we have, in that period we have in Babel, Abaye, Rava, Rav Nachman, Bar Yitzchak. The fifth generation, year 352 to 385, and of course there's overlapping, just to give you a sense, we have Rav Papa, Rav Huna Bred, Rav Yeshua, these are all in Babel. It has moved to Babel already. Rav Papi, Rav Zvid, Rav Zvid Menahardo, there are two Rav Zvids, Rav Kahana, another Rav Kahana than the one before, Rav Chama Menahardo, Amemar, this is fifth generation. Sixth generation is Ravina, Rav Ashi, as we discussed before, Meremer, Marzutra, Rabbi Abba, this was, Rabbi Abba, it seems to be a scholar from Israel who moved to Babylon. Rav Acha Bar Rava, Rav Acha Bar Rava, colleague of Rav Ashi's, who was the head of the Masifta and Pumpadisa at the time. This is the period up until which we've discussed. The seventh generation, and further on, and the time of the Savaroy is the topic of the last lecture of this series, of how the Talmud took its final form, and the history and the persecutions that occurred during this period of time. Any questions?
How long period of time did it take Ravashi to put it together?
Ravashi was Rosh Hashiva for 55 years. Rav Isaac Halevi assumes that it was towards the end of his lifetime when he was able to command universal respect. That's when there was the holdovers of the previous generations, so that even though he was probably a person still of such great stature, but it wasn't as recognized. And he assumes that a little later on, maybe the last 40 years or 35 years. No, so it was a constant conclave. It lasted for 35 years. You know, they came together, you know, that. So the writing of the down, so I have this, this Rav Isaac Halevi assumes, and that this happened here, like the year 589 or something. This is much after, you know, this is much after this period of time. Yeah, Rav Ashi died in the year 427. So we're dealing like 150 years later. No. Everything was, I mean, it could be compared to their own private notes, but basically as it was studied as a text, everyone memorized this. I mean, you know, there are yeshivas, not in Lithuanian yeshivas today, but Hungarian yeshivas, you know, that they memorized this, the vast parts of Talmud just by heart. You knew it Baal Peh. You know. Yeah. So this is the Mishnah is a question. I said the Rambam maintains, and there's literature from the period of the Gaonim, that it would seem that it was written down. But Rashi, and from the French schools, has maintained that it was not written down until later. The Mishnah. Like ours. They did except without the Rashi in the Tosfos. No, there were scrolls. Scrolls, and they were divided into chapters and the Mishnahs as we have it today, but without pages. There was no standard. What? It's not clear. At the time of printing, the standard pages we have is like from the year 1520. There's a Bamberg Schloss. That's where we have the standard pages of our Talmud. I guess it's a case-by-case kind of a thing. I don't know if there's any hard and fast rule. Yeah?
You said that Moshe was dealing with the size of the
Correct.
What do you mean by oral Torah? Compared to what we're
talking about here. It was given like the Mishnayos, but a much greater expanded form. Right. I mean, this vast thing of law.
Right.
The derivations of them, that's part of Talmud.